Hey, and welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a man that found me through the website and is one of my interviews. That's awesome. That is so cool. Welcome, Mike Kremloff, and your film, A Place to Call His Own.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it was awesome. I was really shocked to get your email. It kind of came out of the blue, and I thought it was awesome. It really made me happy. Now, this has got to be a very personal film, I would think, after watching it to you personally. I mean, this is a good friend of yours that died.
Yeah, it was. He was probably the closest friend of mine out of high school. We became the closest once we graduated high school. We both graduated in 2009, and then we reconnected, I think it was like 2011. And so about the last 9 months or so of his life, we were spending almost every day with each other, literally. Neither of us were really working at the time, and we were both living at home, so we had no real responsibilities. So we were able to just kind of capture our youth together and spend every waking minute with each other, which brought us very close.
I guess my first question is, why did you make this film?
Well, the idea kind of sparked about 7 months after he passed away. I was just video journaling my thoughts about what had happened to him and, you know, how I was kind of dealing with a passing as close as, you know, he died. And I stopped midway and I thought, wait a minute, I had this eureka moment. I said, you know, I'm a filmmaker. I have loved film ever since, you know, I was 9 years old. I've been doing this for almost 20 years. It was the one thing that Matt always wanted to see me prosper in. Like, why don't I bring other people that were close with him together and I try to get the money together for this, and I make this kind of bare bones, not like technically great, but kind of narratively driven documentary in the style of my experimental work that I've done for a long time. And I kind of immortalize his spirit. And I immediately the next day rode my bike over to his parents' house and pitched them the idea, and they wrote me a check for $10,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was like it was an immediate like, yes, do it. We believe in you. We're behind you 110%. And, you know, the sky was the limit for me at that point. I was completely, you know, I how old was I when I started this? I was 22, I think, or I had just turned, I had just turned 22. So it was just kind of like mind blowing, like, oh my God, it was, there was no arguments, no, like, well, maybe we'll think about it. It was immediately like, we know what you're capable of. We believe in you. We want you to do something nice for our son. And to this day, they still, you know, every, on the year anniversary of his passing, they'll always call me and make sure I'm doing okay. So,
well, that's very nice of them. I mean, now I'm trying to think. I got to ask my first question. How do you feel about street racing?
How do I? Well, I'll say this: before his accident, I was like, not to stereotype, but I was like any other suburban teenager my age. Didn't bother me. It was, you know, it wasn't something that I thought twice about. Like, I've never been into cars or anything, so the adrenaline rush that most street racers get, like, that's not my thing. You know, my whole life has been behind cameras. That's where I guess I get my adrenaline from, or my endorphin buzz is by creating. Matt was street racing, and so I did partake in a couple races with him, some in Chicago, some out in the suburbs where we grew up. And, you know, it was, he knew how to, I mean, this is very ironic considering what happened to him, but he knew how to handle a car better than anyone that I've ever met, which I think is part of why it was so shocking to hear that he had passed away in the way that he did. It wasn't surprising given the fact that we all knew that he did that. But it just kind of, I was just like, I just, there had to have been something that I went wrong with the car. It was just, that was the immediate, like, kind of denial response. Like, there's no way that Matt could have misjudged something that would have caused him to, his car to end up in a light pole. So it, ever since his passing, I'm completely against it. You know, I, in a way, kind of deal with it almost on a daily basis. I live in downtown Chicago now, and right across from me is Lower Wacker Drive, and there's street racing every night, more so in the spring and summer, and so I hear them all the time. And every time I hear that, it just, my blood starts boiling, because it's like once something traumatic, like you lose your best friend to something like that, regardless of the way, what it might be, in my case, it was street racing, you just, everything about it, you just, you hate it, and because it's the one thing that took something very special away from you, so.
I guess my next question was it hard to get the people together, or were you still friends with these friends? Were they your friends too?
Yeah, everybody that I interviewed at the time, I did have a friendship with as well. I am still in communication with most of them. Some of us just kind of drifted apart just because, you know, we're just going down different paths and, you know, time changes things. It was no bad blood or anything. But yeah, I basically, after I got the blessing of Matt's family, I went and contacted all of these people personally and, you know, just said, hey, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, all of them without a hitch said, all right, you let me know when you want me to do it and I'll do it. And, you know, I think that was kind of the great thing about not only just Matt, but just my whole friend group in general in high school, because everybody that I interviewed, I knew and from high school, is that they all were very supportive of what I do and what I aspire to be, as a filmmaker. And they always enjoyed being a part of anything that I invited them to do. And I think that, so I think a couple of them almost expected me before I even had the idea to do something for Matt in some way. So yeah, I mean, there was absolutely no hiccups or frustrations or, you know, speed bumps in the getting this done, in terms of people's involvement.
I guess my next question is, did you think of doing anything different than a documentary, or that was always your plan?
Yeah, that was always my plan, was to do a documentary. I have thought in the very, very back of my mind of creating another film and it being kind of a loosely based on events narrative about what happened. But I don't really know if, A, I would have the patience to sit down and actually write that screenplay, and B, if it's something that, I don't think like a narrative film would be something that Matt's family would be for, and I wouldn't do anything involving Matt unless I got his family's blessing. So I think, no pun intended, the road probably ends at this documentary. But I have entertained the thought in my own head of kind of making a coming of age, kind of dark John Hughes-esque movie about, well, what would happen if a very tight group of friends lost, you know, one of their most selfless counterparts, you know, how would they go through it? Because, you know, one of the things that I really am very fortunate about is that in the group of friends that were really close with Matt, in the very beginning, I was dealing with it in a way that was productive and it wasn't damaging, because normally in death, a lot of people can turn to very malicious things, whether it be drugs or alcohol or whatever. And there were many people that turned to that when Matt passed away, and I turned to my video camera. So that in and of itself, I think, kind of saved me from going down a bad road and dealing with the stages of grief that we all in some way at some point have to deal with in a very negative way. So, yeah, I tend to ramble. I apologize.
No, perfect. I like it. I don't have to talk. It's awesome. I didn't even know. You said you knew all these people. Now, were you in contact with them regularly, or when you started the doc, you had to go looking for phone numbers, or it just all worked out?
Oh, yeah, no. We were all – I was very close with all of them at the time of me recording the interviews. The timeline of making the film – is kind of jumbled up. The if you notice, like in the cut that I sent you, which is the final version of the movie, in the beginning it puts a date mark of 2013.
Yes.
I interviewed all of these people in 2013, and the final cut of the film came out May of last year, on the 5th anniversary of
the past. Oh, wow. So, okay. I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, so because the film has had a couple of different iterations. It started as a short film, which had those interviews in the final cut. And it played at the Naperville Film Festival in Naperville, Illinois. And I was able to sell out a 300 seat theater, which was really, really cool because I never experienced that as a filmmaker. And I think whether you're big budget, low budget, the moment that you get a theatrical screening of something of yours, and then you finally not only do that, but you're able to fill a whole theater. It's just like, wow, okay, there's a reason why I'm doing this. You know, like, it was a really good feeling. And then afterwards, I made one feature-length version that was kind of more morbid and dark, and it was kind of dealing with the what I was personally going through in losing my best friend. And, you know, after some time passed, I remember revisiting it and was like, you know what, this isn't how this project's supposed to be left. It was just really dark, and it kind of left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. And so I went back and kind of restructured the edit from scratch. And my buddy from film school did some aerial drone shots for me. And what you see on my YouTube account is what the final version is. And I think that that's probably, it's like the short film, but better. So.
My next question is, you include some short films of you and Matt. You guys were just screwing around, it looks like, just hanging out, shooting some stuff.
Yeah.
Was that a common occurrence you guys did?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with those videos are that basically when I was a teenager, my first introduction, as I would call it, of film school is I self-taught myself, I'd say about 95% of the stuff that I know today, and it was just by going out and doing it. You know, I had video cameras, and I thought there's no other way that I'm going to learn and be able to do what I want to do other than just going out and doing it and not waiting for money or waiting for formal training or, you know, whatever else. And so I spent the better part of my teenage years just making these kind of experimental video pieces or kind of like these montage vlog type things with music about like encapsulating days, you know, with my friends. And when Matt and I would hang out, I was basically just an extension of that. You know, I would always have a camera on me and I would just make these little video art pieces with him. And I think that's probably one of the weirdest coincidental things about the film is that I had all of this kind of organic footage of he and I just hanging out and being young together and just being best friends with each other and going to Chicago and, you know, like the stuff on the parking garage. And then all of a sudden he passes away and it's like, whoa. Okay. So it's like I immortalized the last kind of months of his life, not knowing that they would hold of greater value down the road, which is just, it's still to this day, it's just kind of weird how all of that kind of linked itself together in kind of a weird way, you know? And it's like, not to sound superstitious or anything, but, you know, I remember having talks with Matt and, you know, he always would say, you know, if there's one thing that I can do for you is I want you to become successful as a filmmaker. And it's almost like, I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know, but I feel like Matt in some way had some sort of a hand in the making of this film. And, you know, whether there is an afterlife or not, you know, I'm kind of in between on all of that. But if he is somewhere, it's too coincidental for me to be like, I have all of this footage. I have all of this, like we got really, really close, really, really fast. And all of a sudden everything comes to a halt and I'm left with this kind of visual immortalization of what I experienced with him when we were that close. And it's just, I don't know. It's just weird.
Okay. That's all good. All good. My question is, you said you have a lot of footage. So how did you decide what to show? I think it was Johnny Rockets you're in the one when we kind of Matt's personality and a little bit what he wants to do with his life. I think it's Johnny Rockets.
We were at Steak and Shake.
Okay, sorry. I'm trying to figure out where it was. I'm like, we don't have one, so I'm guessing.
All those places look the same. Yeah, that was another thing. That was the morning of my 21st birthday. we had gone to a hookah bar, and it was my friend Matt and my friend Ben, and they took me out to Steak and Shake. It was like 2 in the morning, and I had this really crappy cell phone at the time that didn't take that great a video, but I was like, you know what, 21 is like a monumental year. I'm going to be sentimental and sappy and stupid and throw my camera phone in my friends' faces and start asking them all of these personal questions and kind of like yearbook-like things. And in all honesty, because I don't really keep the raw footage of anything that I do creatively just because I can't afford the hard drive space. So the only thing that I keep is the actual piece that I make. But because of the situation, I kept all of that, all of the questions that I asked them that night are still sitting on a hard drive, and it's the only footage to this day that I have actually of Matt talking. So I remember just kind of going through my hard drives and looking at it, and I stumbled upon it. And after getting past the emotional episode that I had of finding that again after he passed away, I was like, this is perfect, because I literally am asking him, what do you value the most out of you and I, and what do you want? What do you want me to, you know, be, and how do you want me to act, and what do you expect of me, kind of as an adult sort of thing? And it's just, yeah, that was a good time. That was a lot of fun.
Coming away from this film, I discovered, I mean, I think Matt was a very compassionate person,
mm-hmm.
and he seemed to do everything for everyone.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's just what you portrayed or what the people you asked the people to say, or you know what I mean? But is that what I should be taking away from this film?
Yeah. Matt was there's a part of his dad's interview that I didn't include where he describes him the best as, you know, because I think I remember asking him, like, how would you summarize Matt's character or something like that? And he said, I would compare him to John Candy and Uncle Buck, where okay. he's on that line of he has a really, really big heart and he wants nothing but the best for himself and he couldn't hurt a fly, you know? And it's one of those things where he was one of those people where from an image standpoint, he looked like somebody that was careless and was violent and, you know, the whole don't judge a book by its cover sort of thing really played hard with him. And he was a teddy bear. You know, he was somebody that I think one of the best stories I heard about him, which I wish I included in the film, but I didn't find out until after the movie was over, was he was just doing a joyride around the suburbs where we lived one night. And he came across a guy in downtown Aurora, Illinois, who was in the process of thinking about committing suicide. And he stopped and sat down with this guy on the bench and came to find out that he was a Army veteran and he was suffering major PTSD, that I guess his wife had just left him, the whole nine yards thing. And Matt not only talked him out of taking his own life, he got him a job, and he gave him, I think, like $3,000 or $4,000 cash that night to make sure he was okay. And I didn't realize this. I was not even told this until after the film. His dad told me the story, that this guy showed up to Matt's wake in tears and told his father everything and said, you know, your son basically saved my life. And I think I'm a very nice person, that it's the whole treat people the way you want to be treated kind of thing. I don't mean ill will towards anyone, but I have never in a million years, especially at that point in time, somebody in our age demographic to be that selfless and that kind of like, you know, it just, I can't even really vocalize it. Like I can't figure out words to explain him. He just, I don't know. You know, he really went out of his way for other people, but it did take a toll on himself. Like there would be times where he would get really, really depressed and he would just, you know, be like, I put all this energy into other people, but I don't get really anything back in return. And, you know, I don't know if I included what I said here in the final cut of the movie. I remember saying it on camera, but along the lines of, he told me one day that if he had just disappeared one day, that nobody would care, that people would just go about their lives and nobody would notice that he was gone. And the exact opposite of that happened at his wake, when almost, if not, I think over 1,000 people showed up, when he only had, to my knowledge, you know, maybe 2-3 really close friends, you know, including myself. So to see this mass amount of people turn out to his wake was like, man, I really wish he could have seen that. Like, he would have had some hope and to be like, listen, like, there's a reason why you're being selfless like this. And even though you can't see it in the moment of the impact you're leaving on these people, it will be felt as long as they are alive, and so on and so on and so on and so on. You kind of have to have blind faith in doing things like that, which I think he kind of got weary on because he wanted to see a result of the good that he put out. And sometimes it never came back to him and he would get really depressed. Like, why am I doing this? So yes, in a big rambling explanation, yes, Matt was a fantastic guy. And I don't really think the film does even half the justice of his character that he actually had. You know, he was an amazing human being, and he was someone that I personally believe that others should model themselves on. You know, we need more people like Matt in the world, especially with Trump in office.
Wow. Not to date this podcast. Did you have anybody you couldn't find for the podcast? For the film.
What was the question?
Did you not be able to find anybody? I mean, you're saying 1,000 people came to the wake. I mean, I guess you weren't making the film then, obviously. But afterwards, were you looking for the Army vet? Were you looking for people to interview that you couldn't find?
I basically wanted to stick to the people that Matt and I were both very close with, because I knew that, because in the beginning I just thought this was going to be like a 10-minute short film. So I wasn't thinking in the practical sense of, oh, this could be kind of a short feature length. You know, I think the movie's at like 50 or 60 minutes. I don't even remember the runtime.
56 minutes, 27 seconds.
Yeah, 56 minutes. Okay, so it's just under an hour. And so I think from a comfort level, because everything still was very, very fresh when I did those interviews, I looked at it from a logical standpoint of the people that I can get the quickest and that will say yes and that will feel comfortable with me interviewing them, talking about sensitive stuff, would be the people that know me really well. You know, we already have that rapport of, I trust Michael, you know, I know where he's going with this. Because, of course, there's a lot of people, that, like I said, that showed up at the wake. I didn't know who they were. And the friends that I interviewed in the film, they didn't know who they were. So, you know, yeah, I think it would have delayed the film, but I think it also, I don't know. I think there's some kind of chemistry that comes from me just focusing on the people that were in his life on like a daily basis in that regard, like I was, you know.
During your interviews, I'm going to have to ask, how long after the wake were these interviews done? Because nobody looks comfortable.
Yeah.
None of them look comfortable. I mean, I'm not saying I'd be in a good mood after my friend died, but they did not look like they wanted to have a conversation. I mean, they did it, I'm sure, for their friend, but they did not look comfortable.
Yeah, none of us, from an emotional standpoint, really were. Well, he died May of 2012, and I conducted the interviews between February and March of 2013.
So that's still pretty fresh.
Yeah, it's still very fresh, yeah. And I mean, and if you even notice, I don't know. I know that there's, like, baby footage of him.
There is.
But Matt has a twin brother that is not in the film. If you know, I don't even interview his twin brother.
I was going to, I wasn't sure if I should ask Dennis, I think his name is.
Yeah, Dennis, yeah.
I didn't know if I should ask about him or not, because he wasn't touched on. So I'm like, maybe I just won't say anything.
He was in the short film, but when I came back and said, you know what, I'm going to make this into a feature, I'm going to release it on YouTube for free. Like, every time I would make changes to the project, I would first go to Matt's family and say, can I continue this? You know, because it's just out of respect. You know, I'm not going to do something without their okay. And when, at that point, I had lost touch with Dennis. Dennis and I were fairly close, not as close as Matt and I, but so I went through his their mother, and I said, hey, would Dennis be okay if I redid his interview? He was the one interview that I wanted to redo, because his interview was relatively short because he was very emotional the first time that I did interview him, so I kind of just stopped it. And he said no. He's like, Dennis wants nothing to do with this. Like, he gives you his blessing, but he does not want to be involved in it. So I proceeded onward without, you know.
I'm glad you told me that, because I didn't know if I should touch on it or not. I'm kind of like, did Dennis die? And I don't know about it. He never touched on it, so I didn't want to go there.
Yeah, it was just a matter of the edit and of, you know, what Matt's mom told me, and I was like, okay, then I'll just go forward with just his friends and you and his dad and me and call it a day.
Kind of strange his brother wouldn't do it then, because I was wondering the whole film when he was going to show up, and he never did. So I said, okay.
Yeah.
I kind of let that go. I do have a question. Is speed racing common at his age?
Yeah, and the sad thing is, I know it's not just like a Midwestern or a Chicago problem. I know it's all over the country. But there's a lot of people between the ages of 16 and I would say all the way up to the mid-30s of people drag racing around, at least where I'm at, around the Chicago area. I mean, it's insane. I mean, just last summer, there were like 3 or 4 kids that were between the ages of 19 and 23 that got arrested for street racing in my hometown. So I don't get it. I don't understand, you know, the reason behind it. And I also don't really appreciate how little it seems the authorities do, at least here in Chicago, where I'm calling the non-emergency number saying, hey, I've got people across the Chicago River for me street racing. Could you like do something about it? And they don't. They're just like, oh yeah, we know. They'll leave soon. And they just hang up on me. It's like, oh, that's not really the way to go about that, but okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's insane. I do have a couple of shot questions you took during your film.
Sure.
Did you shoot an actual funeral, his funeral procession, or did you have made that one up?
Oh, okay. So that was the footage of the cars driving the procession, that was the original ending of the original short film.
Okay.
And that was staged. That was something where, and again, I think this might have been a detail that I might have left out in the final cut. It's been a while since I've watched the movie, but
it's all good.
One of the things that Matt's really close friends that I interviewed did immediately after we got out of the church at his funeral was they spray painted their tire rims orange in memorial for him, because his tires were that way. And so during the kind of creating of the original short, I said, hey, wouldn't it be great if I got you guys to go from the cemetery to the parking garage where we all used to hang out and loiter and whatnot, and it would be kind of like this memorial drive for Matt, and I would end the film that way. And so I just found a different creative outlet to use that material in the final version of the movie. So yeah, no, that wasn't an actual like, oh yeah, this is like the legit thing and I'm just filming it. This was staged. It was many months later after everything had happened. And I think we did like two or three takes of that. I remember being really cold that day. It was not a whole lot of fun to shoot when you're in the dead of winter in Chicago and you're telling people, okay, now just go around again. Just go around again. People lose their patience.
Well, they don't get it. Now your final shot is the headstone of the film. Now, did you have any problems with shooting in the cemetery, or you just went and did it and didn't say anything?
Yeah, it was kind of guerrilla style. Of course, I let Matt's family know, and they're like, oh yeah, do whatever. But I know that I probably should have gone to the church for permission, but we showed up and kind of just did a guerrilla style. And I remember being very nervous that day. I'm like, okay, we need to get these shots as quick as possible and get out of here. And that last shot was something that the drone operator just kind of improvised when we were trying to figure things out. I think he was actually trying to like align something and he was just recording at the time. So there wasn't any direction for me or anything. That was kind of his off the cuff. Like, I don't know if it was an intentional shot that he did or if it was just something that he was trying to figure out his controls, but, it's a great shot. I think it's one of my favorite shots in the whole movie.
Mine too.
Yeah. And it's very, what's the word? I'm going to be lost on a word here. I don't want to say subliminal. I'm having a brain fart. I apologize. The whole reason why I did the drone shots was from a creative standpoint, I saw the drone as Matt. So okay. It's kind of like every time that you see a shot of, you know, our town or the parking garage or the church that we, you know, had his funeral in or the cemetery, or even, you know, in the beginning where it's one long shot down the last stretch of road he ever drove down, and then it lands at his crash site with me standing there kind of reflecting, that was supposed to be him. So the whole drone thing from a creative standpoint was supposed to be this kind of like metaphorical, it's Matt looking over everyone. It's Matt looking over his town. It's Matt looking over me, remembering him and what he did for me kind of thing. And that was the reason why I did that. That was kind of a little added thing. And when I explained that to my friend, he was like, okay, I'll do it for free. Cause I was afraid that he was going to charge me stuff. And I'm like, I don't know if I can pay you, man. And when I explained to him like how I was going to be using the drone, he's like, I wouldn't have even thought of that. And so he thankfully, cause I was very tight on money at that time, he did all that for free for me. So I really appreciate that.
I just want to back up to one thing I should have asked earlier. The Dennis footage, you didn't show it at all.
Yeah.
Now, I guess I want to know why. Was it that bad? Like, I know it was short, but I think we should have seen it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Dennis has always been kind of iffy on, you know, being involved in the film. I think he was, you were asking, you know, many minutes ago about, people kind of being apprehensive. And I think he was always kind of on that fence. He wanted to do it for his brother and, you know, for his folks. But at the same time, I think Matt's death didn't hit anybody harder than, of course, Matt's family. And Dennis, I think, really, it kind of just socked him in the stomach. And so he was very, very sensitive on whether or not he wanted to be involved in it or not. And, you know, I think that once I got the kind of feedback from his mother saying, you know what, it would probably be best if you just kind of left Dennis out of this.
Okay. So that's where it comes from, his mother, not your choice.
Yeah. I mean, I had the kind of, I would say a half-assed blessing to be able to do it. Like, they would be like, oh, okay, but not really kind of balk at it that much. But just with the way that things were going and, you know, Dennis wanted to move on with his life and he wanted to just kind of get past everything and the project was taking a long time. And I think Dennis just wanted to move on. And so I wanted to respect that, you know, because I, even though I haven't talked to Dennis in quite some time, you know, I'll always respect him. And, you know, so it's just a matter of, it's that line, you know, where is it more important to cater to the film or is it more important, you know, on a case by case basis to cater to the people that you're involving in the film? And for me, this was something that it was a nonprofit project. I wasn't seeking any money, any kind of really anything. I just wanted to get Matt's story out there. And in the same time, it's like the McMahons opened up their life to me. You know, they gave me hours of VHS tapes and all of these stories and everything. And, you know, if at the end of the day, you know, one of them decides, hey, you know what, like, I completely dig what you're doing, but I'd rather just kind of be on the sidelines, that, you know, I'm going to respect that and try to create the best thing that I can do without that person's involvement, you know?
So you've obviously showed the film at the film festival. What's your reaction been to this film? Have other people discovered it, or have you taken it to other film festivals?
it, let's see, the only other, the YouTube version of the movie did play at a, I think it was an online film festival that was, but it was headquartered in Atlanta. It was called the Spotlight Film Awards, and it won third place. So it was that was the first award that I ever won as a filmmaker. I remember getting the email on that. And other than that, the first cut of it, like the short, played at the Naperville Film Festival. And the second version, which is no longer really available to anyone, that I did have on Amazon for a bit, like as a DVD. And I had a buddy of mine in California do all the music for it, so we owned all the rights to it and all that stuff. Because, of course, I can't – even if I wanted to, which I don't, I can't really make any profit off the current version of the movie because of using copyrighted music. You know, that just kind of – that's a no-no. So, you know, I mean, 30,000 people, I think, or 31,000 people have seen it on YouTube. I've had a couple comments. You know, I had the original short film, I had a full-page write-up in the Chicago Sun-Times about it, which was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
But, you know, I think it's a very kind of localized thing. It's not... it hasn't reached, I guess, the level of audience that I would like his story to get to. Because I think the moral of the film, the whole purpose of this is to be reminded to make sure that you respect the people that are in your life because, you know, they're there for a reason. They're impacting you in great ways, people that are like Matt in your life. And, you know, you're never going to know when your time's up with them. So the film is kind of acting as kind of like a cautious reminder to, you know, don't let the petty shit get under your skin with someone, you know, someone that you care about, because you could wake up tomorrow and realize that, you know, their car hit a light pole, you know. So it's taking that moment of reflection of who's important, what matters, am I living my life to the fullest, you know. Am I doing what's right? Am I being good to others? That's the whole thing.
Give your sound guy a shout out. Cause I have, I mean, he used the music a few times in the film. I don't find it very strong, but I do hear it. So give him a shout out.
Oh, Josh Crawford.
Yeah. Come on. Give Josh Crawford some pops. Cause I know you're going to tell him to listen to this. So we're going to have to talk about him.
Yeah. Josh is a great guy. He's out in California, kind of close to Los Angeles. I don't remember the exact town he lives in.
All good.
But I found him off of SoundCloud when I was doing the original short film, and I really liked, he had like some very experimental, drone-like, kind of David Lynch-esque music on his SoundCloud, and I was like, I really dig this. And I messaged him and said, hey, you know, I know you don't know me, but I really like your sounds. I'm working on this documentary. Is there any chance you could make some music? Like, I've never worked with a musician before. I don't know how this works, but, you know, would you be down? And he saw some of my work and he's like, absolutely, I'd be there for you in a heartbeat. He did all of his work for the short film and for the version that you saw for free. And the really cool thing about the original score that he did on the short, which I think is on his, he's got a Bandcamp and a SoundCloud account still, is that he scored my entire short by plugging an electric guitar into his iPhone. That's it.
Wow.
Yeah. I was like, okay, that's, so when he told me that, I was like, here, I'm going to give you my old Mac. You're going to learn Logic and GarageBand and you're going to make stuff that is so much technically better, but he was already kicking ass just by using a phone and a guitar. I couldn't wrap my head around that. I'm like, how, you did what?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I just plugged my guitar in and I just made some riffs and I added some stuff and then I sent you an email of the WAV file. I'm like, that's the world we're living in now.
That's cool. That's really cool. Do you plan on releasing this on DVD or no? That's it.
Yeah, no, it's just going to be YouTube and that's it. I think the only people that I would do a DVD or a Blu-ray for would be someone in Matt's family or somebody that was directly involved in the movie. That's it.
Okay. Do you want fun questions, or is this too much of a downer for you to give you fun questions?
Oh, I don't, whichever way this is your interview.
Okay, well, I always give everybody fun questions, and I'm like, I don't know, maybe this is too much of a downer for you to have this interview. So I can give you fun questions.
Okay.
It's all good. Favorite film?
Favorite film would be Gore Verbinski's The Weatherman.
Oh, my God. We're going to go to war on this one, a film I did not enjoy at all.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those things where it's like, wait a minute, you're a filmmaker, and you've seen all of these movies, and you love all of these directors, and you land on that. I'm like, I don't know.
It appeals to you. I'll give it to you. I had a guy tell me Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'm like, pardon? Really?
Yeah.
And I mean, I always laugh at people's choices. It's Friday night. We can even take it back. I'll kick it back to your 21. You're hanging out with Matt. What film did you guys watch?
Ooh. And I'm going to give you a dark answer. One of our favorite movies was one of my friends. It's called I Melt With You.
I do not know it.
It's with Rob Lowe. And, oh, my God,
I definitely have
Thomas Jane, a old Facebook film acquaintance of mine, Mark Pellington, directed it. He did The Mothman Prophecies and Arlington Road with
Arlington Road's pretty dark.
Yeah, Arlington Road, yeah. So that was I don't want to give the movie away in case there's people out there that haven't seen it.
I have not seen it.
But it has a very, very, like, dark, fucked up twist to it. Where even in the marketing, you don't really know. If you just watch the trailer, it's like, okay, something really screwed up happens. Like, this is a dark movie. But you don't really know what it is. And then when it happens, as long as you keep yourself away from the spoilers and you just let it surprise you, you're like in deep despair the rest of the fucking movie. But for whatever reason, I don't know. That was a movie that Matt and I would watch. We also watched The Breakfast Club a lot. And the last movie I ever watched with him, which was a re-release, was Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That was the last thing I ever did with him. It was the Saturday before he died. We went into this, like, old school theater in Wheaton, or not Wheaton, it was Downers Grove, Illinois. And we saw a 35mm print of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and that was the last thing I ever did with him. The last time I ever saw him.
The last question, you're at the concession stand, what do you buy?
What do I what?
What do you eat at the concession stand at the movie theater?
Oh, what do I eat? Oh my God. Besides the cliche popcorn, I would say Milk Duds are probably my favorite candy.
That's all good, man. It's all good. I do have my final questions, and not really fun. Are you still making films, or is this it? Because what are you doing?
As of right now, professionally, like in terms of what's bringing me money home, is I'm actually working as a camera technician for a company called VER, which they're located all over the world. I think they have like 30 locations here in America. They've got some places up in Canada. They've got one in Toronto, Montreal. So I kind of entice my lovings of cameras in that way, on a monetary standpoint. But in terms of films, like I still experiment from time to time. I'm definitely not as prolific as when I was younger. I think that has to do partly with just how much life has changed. I don't have as much free time as I used to. You know, I'm almost 30 and, you know, responsibilities, being an adult, growing, you know, all of that stuff. It's just kind of dwindled down my time to be creative. But my creativity has definitely not died in me, and I don't think it ever really will. I'll just kind of always be at ends to create. But, no, I do plan – there's a screenplay that I wrote when I was 18 that I've been nitpicking at ever since. It's kind of this LGBT coming of age, John Hughes-esque. I reference John Hughes a lot because he's my favorite filmmaker. That I wrote when I was 18 years old, and I'm trying to get that made, but it's the whole process of trying to get people to finance it you know, it's just, it's, I think that's one of the biggest hurdles when you're trying to make a narrative kind of fictional feature length movie, is trying to find people that will give you enough money in order to let you play in your playground, you know, and, you know, for somebody like me, who's an unknown, you know, gambling on somebody like me is a very big risk. You know, it's like, we're not going to give you $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 to make a low budget, you know, coming of age movie when we don't know if you're going to make us a return. And that's the part of filmmaking I think a lot of people in the indie world hate, is the business side of it. Because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, and something that I was in denial in a lot as a teenager, is that filmmaking is still a business. And it's like, you know, there's certain projects that nobody's going to come knocking at your door or, you know, sign a contract with their name on it for your project unless they know that you can make them money, which is really sad. You know, it's something that I don't necessarily agree with. But I guess, as I ramble again, I apologize. My goals are, I would really like to be a filmmaker as my full-time job. Like, I would really like to be able to make a living off of creating instead of being a technician in an office. You know, like, I enjoy both things, but I enjoy creating a hell of a lot more than running signal through cameras all day, you know? So, I think in terms of the projects that I would like to make, if I'm able to do so, would very much, like I said, would very much be in the vein of John Hughes's films. I don't think so much in terms of like the teenage thing, but very Midwestern. Of course, I have an affinity, a love and appreciation for where I'm from in Chicago and from Naperville. And so I have that connection with John, and, you know, basically just telling stories about characters that you could bump into on the street, and more so characters that I don't feel, you know, that do exist in the real world in some, under some name or some profession, but don't get enough screen time because they're not maybe interesting enough, or they're not, you know, they're quirky or whatever else. I think one of the big things for me growing up, was the films that I connected to the most were the ones where, you know, cause I was kind of an outcast, you know, I wasn't a popular kid. I wasn't a socialite. So I know what it feels like to be in the back of the theater and see something on the screen and say, hey, that's me. And I want to be able to do that for somebody else, you know, to be able to kind of give that person who they don't think has a voice, to give them a voice. And in a way, I feel like with my documentary, I did that for Matt, because Matt was very much an outcast. He was very much kind of an underdog trying to do the best thing that he could do. And even though he, of course, wasn't able to see the film, it still kind of has that, hey, that's me kind of thing, because you can kind of tell that, you know, Matt's definitely not a jock. He's not a popular guy. He's not, you know, this person that, you know, it's, I don't know. I've always found people like that the most interesting, either in a nonfiction or a fictitious setting, because I think that they have a lot to give that they haven't been able to give a chance to in cinema. And I think that's, that besides being Chicago, is one of the big reasons why I admire John Hughes so much. And, you know, I could ramble for days about John Hughes. So.
Well, I want to cut you off there. I want to thank you for your time. Thank you for sending me your film, and thank you for doing this interview. Hello?
Your signal was going out.
Oh, sorry. I just thanked you for everything. That's all. It's nothing exciting. Hold on.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.